My name is Andrew Walmsley, and you're listening to episode 147 of Photography Insights. This is the photography podcast that interviews people from the photography world. So we change our thought process and stance on photography fields today. After speaking with Michael Snyder a few weeks ago, I wanted to start exploring another subject that really interests me, that is, namely science. Robert Dash is in his sixth decade, as he calls it, and an educator, naturalist, and photographer from the USA. He has many exhibitions, been published in Nat Geo, and even spoke at TEDx. Robert piqued my interest after looking at the Blue Earth Alliance, a lovely not-for-profit organisation. They help promote photography projects, obtain backing and research for photographers. Robert is a very experienced person and talks about his love of the environment, climate and nature. He provides information on his process when working with food and talks about his childhood memories of turning over rocks and spotting Mother Nature herself. So in this one we discuss climate change, presenting food, finding publishers, macro, micrograph and montage, food conversation, travelling exhibitions, focus stacking. And of course, if you stay to the end for our random questions, you'll find out why we need Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Robert also advises everyone to watch a couple of films. The first one's called Kiss the Ground on Netflix. I've watched that personally and I think it's a fantastic documentary. That we should all watch. And the other one is by Chris Jordan. It's called Albatross. And there will be links in the show notes to these, so do check them out. Of course, there are links to Robert's Instagram and his website and the Blue Earth Alliance. And he's been kind enough to forward me some photos, so please do check those out and you'll get to see a bit more detail in what we're talking about during the podcast, because it's very unique what he's trying to do. And of course I always like to mention the friends of the show. Steve at Chroma, I know he's busy working away. We had a chat only today actually. And don't forget your C51 developing needs at filmdev.kk. This week I was pleased to say I finally met up with Pete from Static Age. That's been a couple of years since we got together, so it was really good. We got to do a little bit of the things that we both love shooting, so it was a bit of like the abandoned side, and also looking at some of the mundane life on the streets of a local town. And if you look on Instagram you'll see something we spotted in one of the alleyways, and it was a nice little fun shot. So cheers Pete, as always, an absolute bloody pleasure mate, and I'll look forward to you showing me around your home areas. I suppose all we really need to do is play the music, but I just wanted to apologise first and say sorry this one's a little bit late. I'm actually on holiday this week, so I've been off chilling a little bit with my family, watching a bit of films, a little bit of gardening, etc. So photography's sort of been in and out of my mind a little bit, and it's one of them times when I tend to relax a little bit about schedules and things. So yeah, all will be normal again for next week. So let's play the intro music and away our fantastic guest Robert Dash. And welcome to the show, Robert.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, it's been great to come across your work because, it's very unique what you've done compared to a lot of photographers I've interviewed.
Well, I look forward to exploring some of the background, how it got to be so, and thank you again.
No, not a problem. Obviously, we have a certain man to thank for introducing me to the Blue Alliance group that you're part of. So thanks to Mr. Snyder there. That was very kind of him.
Very talented, very highly motivated and creative individual. Michael does a great job, and Blue Earth Alliance is a wonderful group to be part of.
It was nice that he introduced like a group rather than a person, and I thought that was really unique.
That gives you a chance to see a whole variety of other work out there, and you could follow up for a year on that one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I did say to him, I've interviewed a lot of artists now, so it'd be lovely to explore science. I'm a massive interest in science for many, many years. So for me, it's covers two things I love. So as soon as I started looking through, I mean, I think you I only looked at like two, three artists, and I was like, oh my God, here we go. I've already found someone, and you were first to reply. I was like, oh, this is brilliant. So.
Yeah, the science, art and science have always fascinated me, at least as an adult. And photography is just a fantastic way to explore that. There's so many possibilities and stories to tell, things to explore, and we'll get into it further here. But when I get close up to something, looking at it very carefully, I end up finding patterns and textures and what would you say? Structures that are so confusing and mysterious that they could be the subject of a PhD dissertation or a lifetime career. Just by looking at something carefully, maybe seeing something that no one's ever seen before, or asking a question about something, and it becomes a whole world or a whole lifetime of inquiry. So that by itself, just curiosity as a scientist is curious, and artists, all of us who are really looking at something carefully, we're curious, what is this? What's it about? And there's a lot of things that have no answer to them. We have no idea what they're about. And so, it's just fascinating to explore that.
Yeah, I think that's what sort of sucks us in, and why nature programs and they do their bit. They all have their place, aren't they? Which is always good. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Blue Earth Alliance then? What's sort of involved
Sure,
in
I
it?
know it's been, I don't know, maybe 30 years now that a couple artists, Natalie Fobbs and Phil Borges, I believe, was the other one, got together, and they were interested in promoting their own projects that they had done great research on, but were unable to really find support for books or for traveling exhibitions and things, because they were individuals, and foundations would say, we can't help you because there's no ability to get any kind of tax deduction here. So they created this organization to support project photographers who can funnel donations through this nonprofit organization and support their work. And so that's the legacy, and a lot of wonderful work has come through that, and that's one of the greatest functions of it.
Right, that's interesting. 'Cause you'd never consider that, in the sense, so it, in reality, the money is quite important in this, isn't it?
Well, if you're making single images, it's one thing. If you have a project that has a narrative that you're trying to get out in the world in whatever way, as a film, as a book, as an exhibition or a workshop or something, oftentimes that could be in the tens of thousands of dollars easily and beyond, way beyond. So trying to be able to approach potential lenders, that's really significant to get that support.
No, Scott. So how did you come across them?
I've known about Blue Earth Alliance for a long time, and when I was developing my Food for Thought project, that's where I applied to them to say, you know, I really would like to pursue this, and I'm going to be needing funding to advance this project, and that's when I was invited in there. So it was a few years back.
Okay. So then they fund your work to continue research? Or
no, they don't fund themselves. It's our job to find funders, and they offer support as well. But but we find the funders, and then it funnels through their nonprofit status.
Yeah. I say. So you're much more than a photographer then, aren't you?
Well, whatever that means. An educator, that's my real career and income has come from teaching. And that really informs my work all the way through, because you know, I can't leave it at just an image. There's so many stories that go with it. I either want to talk about it or write about it. And so that's one part of the story. Another part is, you know, if we're going to put these projects out there, marketing is a huge, huge thing. I think Michael Snyder may have talked to you about that a little bit, but he's done a great job of that. And I'm inspired by his work, just, you know, reaching out in so many different venues to find a place to communicate what we've learned and what we've discovered. And, you know, whether it be publications or organizations or workshops or festivals or museums or galleries or what have you, publishers are all, you know, inundated by so many people. And how do we develop that part of our practice beyond the creation, beyond the education, beyond the, you know, the visioning? How do we also share it with the world and find an audience?
Yeah. Sounds like a very tough thing. Obviously, I've had no experience of this side, you say, so I'm still quite early into creating projects and just sort of finalizing them. So for me, it's quite interesting in that sense.
Absolutely. You know, I've been fascinated by photography and cameras for many decades, back into the 60s. So I'm in my sixth decade now. And, you know, just the satisfaction of seeing something like magic come out of a, you know, on a Polaroid or on a film or what have you, to capture something. So that's the single image, which is fascinating. And over the years, both from feedback from others and from my own kind of watching photography work in the world, what became really fascinating and challenging was, how do you tie images together and create something synergistically beyond that one image? Mm-hmm. You know, connecting dots of stories about climate change, connecting dots of stories about food and food security, or whatever topic it is, whatever fascinates you, that creates a narrative that makes you want to develop a project, right? Develop a project, and however, wherever that's going, is it a podcast? Is it a blog? Is it a web page? Is it a film, book, or a course, or who knows what?
Yeah, it's a good point actually, because any medium's valid in that sense, isn't it? Because, you know, traditionally maybe an artist had a paintbrush or sculpted with his hands, but I think the term can be used for really anything in that sense, can't it?
Absolutely. And whatever you're drawn to, you know, whatever you're enthusiastic about, where you see a possibility or someone invites you or however you want to go forward, it's fascinating to explore.
Yeah, I mean, I started thinking this sort of way, very late into doing years of this, where I realized it was probably more of a project. And then it's become a lesson, and educating myself. It's allowed me to network, form friendships. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah. What it's done for me. It
takes on a world of its own. It's like a snowball going down a mountain.
It does, yeah, that's right, yeah. It's a good analogy,
Basically, I think the fun part of it is no one's really giving you a script. You're following your nose, you're following your fascination, and I don't want to make it too much of a cliche, but it's like jumping in a river and seeing where the river goes. And you're directing yourself to some extent, but are definitely directing yourself, but the river is also taking you, and enjoy the ride. Where is this river taking you? Is it somewhere? It's going to be somewhere you didn't expect. And there's so many wonderful places along the way.
It's definitely been one of the more interesting parts of my photography, talking about it in that sense. Because it's driven me to meet people like yourself and Michael and so many others. And I've learned about history of America. And there's many other countries I'd love to know about more. One of the limiting factors is my lack of communication. One day, I'd love to put the time in and learn another language.
Well, there's you got several lifetimes worth of projects there then.
I've always got too much. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think some of us do, don't we?
For sure. Well, you mentioned, you did send a note out prior to our call here asking about the TEDx talk that I did and how that went. And I want to tie that in to say, I had this body of work, but to create a talk about it caused me to tie together stories and tie together ideas that I didn't even know existed, really. Okay. So, where I'm going here is what happens when you start with images, like single images, and some that are related or a body of work, and then go to a level of, I'm going to present this to the public for why it's significant. And I'm not just saying, well, here's a leaf and here is a tree and here's a pretty picture, but what are the pieces here? What's happening and why is it significant? And that, that's a fantastic challenge. It's a wonderful way to really mine your creativity and say, why is this significant in the world? Why should anybody care? And it's very interesting. It's a very interesting challenge to put oneself to say, all right, can you talk about this for 15 minutes in a way that people would be curious about?
Yeah, but you seem to flow natural because obviously I listen to it, and you like many of the TEDx speakers I've seen, it just flowed like you'd been up on stage for years.
Well, it didn't start that way. And, I basically changed it over and over and over again. And I taped it and listened to myself speaking over and over again while I was doing house chores or on a walk or something, just to make it, like you say, natural. And over and over and over again, hearing it probably, 100 times or more, and others probably do it even more than that. You just have to do repetition. Just no other way around it, because you want to get to the point, like a musician, that the music's playing itself rather than you're trying to think of what note coming next.
Not a lot.
Like muscle memory. You want your body and your mind to know, I already know what I'm speaking, so that I can be present here on the stage. And easier said than done, but
well, it is different, isn't it? Because obviously you're used to using a camera in that way, and that must be all very natural to you now. But to communicate the other side of the process and why you're doing it and what should people think about the work, it's a different skill set altogether.
Sure. And a fascinating one, and I think a really important one. I think it's so important for artists to be able to articulate what they do and why. And it's a blast. It's fun. It gives you a chance to get feedback and to connect with people. And I think one of the greatest joys that I can speak for as a photographer is to interact and have it connect and have the work be part of the world and have people be with the work and say, you know, this moves me in this direction or makes me question this or that. And it reminds me of such and such or whatever it is. So you're in relationship. You know, so much of the practice is solitary, but finding these venues to be in relationship with the work, with other people, just builds the purpose and the meaning and the value of it, I think.
Do you feel the same way, say, for all your projects then?
Oh, everyone's different, but having the chance to talk about it is a blast. I think it's just fascinating to, I think all of us need feedback. We're social animals. To be able to express something, but also know, well, does this make sense to you? If not, maybe I should change it, or maybe you should change your understanding, or, you know, maybe I can explain it better or whatever. All of that is part of the process of trying to clarify a message and trying to, it's honing and crafting your vision. And the world needs vision.
Yeah, it doesn't.
World needs passion. The world needs vision, and the world needs articulate understanding of, you know, of the mystery of life. So, looking at art and science, we're trying to explore what that is. And I think it really is, you know, without getting too far into this, I think it's a it's a service to humanity to find different words and ways to express that mystery.
Yeah, it's a nice way of putting it. And it is important, and it's far more important than some of the everyday stuff and the perfect images like we see on social media, like Instagram. You know, it's time, I think, for science and artists that are creating important work to come out a bit into it. That's more important than some of these beautiful things we see, to be honest.
Well, there are so many issues confronting us, and many of them involve confusion over scientific theory or scientific understanding. And debate about it or denial about it or what have you. And just to enter that is challenging, but to try to enter it in a way that opens people rather than shuts them down is also a fascinating challenge. And so I've been trying to approach the food series through awe and fascination and to look at common foods in a way that no one has seen and go, oh, this is crazy. What is this? And then maybe that leads to, oh, why is this important? And then maybe that leads to, oh, where is my place in this? And, you know, there's no way to control that, but going first for that, it's almost like going for the jugular. It's going for the heart, going for the curiosity and the fascination. And then the questions arise from that, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I know when I first saw these images, I was like, all right, I definitely want to talk to this guy because it's different, but it's about real life things that are out there not getting talked about as much, and you're presenting them in an artistic way, and I really liked that.
Thank you. It's like I say, it's a blast. I love doing the work. It follows up on my lifetime interest in tiny things, in salamanders and frogs and snakes when I was a kid, and always turning over rocks and logs and things.
Okay.
Just discovering things close to the eye. And I've been a, you know, a naturalist in a national park where I've taken people on hikes and things. And I'm always, or I was, when I was doing that, always staring up close and saying, come look down here. Come see this really close up.
Yeah.
So this work has developed with a scanning electron microscope to allow me to take that to new levels. And it's just really a thrilling way to explore those mysteries. And at the same time, let me say, I'm working on a book, and it's very challenging to find a publisher who will say, okay, all this, we can blend all this. In fact, there's a very well-known publisher in your country that had an interest in it and then came back and said, you have scientific imagery, you have fine art photography, and you have environmental commentary, and we don't know how to place this on a shelf, so we're going to pass.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, still working on that. To me, that's the point. The point is all these things blend, and you can't separate them. Art, science, you know, environmental issues, all these things are interrelated, and that's so important to be able to have that kind of whole system view. But then to find a publisher or to find just the right avenue where someone will say, yeah, we know how to market this or we support this is another challenge.
Yeah, I feel for you. Yeah. That's a big, I mean, this is like, to me, if I looked at that, I would say it's an National Geographic type stuff.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. It's just obviously
thank you, yeah.
Different because it's food.
I've talked to them and they like to see work as is. So when I work with photo montage and surreal imagery, they're like, okay. You know, we love
it's not documentary.
We love the electron micrographs, but we're looking for something that's real. So I keep working around finding the interesting possibilities.
Well, we'll just have to make our own, won't we?
Yeah, right.
We'll get a network of people. Let's make our own label. Come on. Another challenge, another lifetime challenge.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it? It's like new stories.
It's ridiculous because people love beautiful imagery, and there's always an avenue to document and talk about it as well. Always. So it's a weird concept there, and I understand that it's not Nat Geo's thing. They have a style, don't they, and they've had it for years. It's just finding that one niche somewhere.
Right. Well, we're I'm optimistic. There's a lot of interesting stuff out there, and one step at a time. I did do a self-publishing project about 5 years ago, and if I have to go that route, I will. I don't really want to. I don't really like having a lot of books in the studio.
Yeah,
but they do go away in time, and then there's an empty space looking to be filled. So we'll see how it goes.
No, that's cool. I mean, we've got to talk more about the project in this sense. Now, what I found interesting, I mean, obviously, for anyone who's listening, probably can't understand what we're talking about. So it literally is microscopic photos, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
But you've done this style where, no, everything looks black and white, but you focused color in certain areas of the picture, aren't you?
Yeah, a little bit more than that. It's montage. Everything in color is a macro image of a certain food, whether it's a blueberry or a carrot leaf or an olive or an olive leaf. And then everything in black and white is a scanning electron micrograph of that olive leaf or that carrot leaf or of the blueberry seed. And what I've done with that then is to create a photomontage, a surreal world where these two talk to each other. The seed of the blueberry and the blueberry itself, or the olive leaf and olive. And so what's happening there is a combination of black and white and color, micro and macro, art and science, fact and imagination, fact and metaphor. So environmental commentary and whimsy, you could say. So I have a lot of things that are happening, a lot of different layers there. And I find that fascinating as an art practice, because I think life is layers, and we live, you know, moment by moment in layers of things that are going on all these different levels. So creating imagery with a story, but also with an impact or an emotional feeling, there's a lot of layers to that, and that's fun to explore. The black and white monochrome in those images, almost everything is, you know, sometimes the width of a pinhead, sometimes maybe, you know, double, triple that or something, but very, very small. Wow. And I start with a stainless steel stub that I take to the microscope that's about the end of my pinky, about that big.
Yeah.
And it has either a seed on it, like a blueberry seed is about the size of a pinhead. It's really tiny. Or a section of a leaf or something. And I take that to the lab and create an image. It's just so small. And yet what you see there, I've created hundreds of images of different foods. And the ones that really make my jaw drop are the ones that end up in the body of work, because, you know, patterns and textures show up that are just things I've never even conceived of before.
It's a very unique method of looking at something. And for me, it's the same as like when you say you go out on a walk, you're looking close up at something. My immediate thing will be to look at the vista in front of you, and you get sucked in by that. So that seems to fit really well with you, because you're looking at close up detail of something that's, you know, you might just normally eat.
What fascinates me is, like Blake's The World in a Grain of Sand, when you look closely at something, huge stories emerge.
Yeah.
So, you know, I started by looking at the leaves of a lot of different trees and the stomata of the leaves. And that's what the TEDx talk was about. Basically, you know, you got these tiny structures that are a fraction width of a pinhead, but that's where it's the turnstile, the interface where all the moisture, almost two-thirds of the moisture, the atmosphere, flow through these little pinhole, you know, smaller than a pinhole cells and pores on a leaf. And oxygen comes through that, carbon dioxide goes in and oxygen comes out. And so there's this phenomenal, you know, trade of atmospheric gases that that help drive the climate on a massive scale, with trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of these stomata. And that you get that story by looking at this tiny structure.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you can make an image of all that atmospheric exchange happen, but when you look at that, it infers this much bigger story. And that's a lot of what I have. I don't necessarily have a picture of climate change, but I have a picture of something that is an inference of it on a micro scale.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but that's an interesting take on it, and it's you in a nutshell. So, and I think you're covering much more, because, you know, what's a climate person going to shoot? It's too hot, floods, a power station, wind turbine. I mean, it, and you're shooting something that is probably more important than any of that. So
it's really fascinating, and there's no end to looking at different parts of it. And the food part came along partway through that work as I was developing that other project. Basically, up to that point, I was shooting almost all nature and almost everything that was wild, right? While some people love street photography, some people love architecture, some people love portraiture or what have you, so many things. And I have always been a nature photographer and studying biology and ecology and natural history and teaching that. And that was my fascination. So when it came to food, it was like, oh, this is human stuff. I'm not interested in that. And the more I considered it, the more I saw, no, food is nature. And if I'm going to be a photographer who's fascinated with conservation and ecosystems and ecosystem recovery, agriculture is one of the giant impacts, and one of the biggest impacts on the planet. When it comes to the loss of biodiversity, when it comes to climate change, and so looking at nature via food allowed all those themes to emerge.
No, it's really interesting. I think what can draw some of you in though is the fact it's maybe something you're used to eating. So for me, the minute you started mentioning blueberries, now do you want to tell everyone, you know, the story behind blueberries and the changes that are coming?
Sure. Blueberries are fascinating for a variety of reasons. As with many foods, the range is shifting, oftentimes toward the poles. And in other words, in the Northern Hemisphere and where I am in the United States, berries are more successful, and some of the large farms are more successful further north as the years go by. And that's creating, a change in who can grow them and where the profits are. Part of what the issue is for blueberries and for almost for so many foods is freak storms, more extreme weather, later freezes, or longer droughts. So this kind of chaotic, very extreme kinds of weather. A lot of these foods have been developed over thousands of years toward more very temperate, very even kinds of conditions, and they're running up against these crazy experiences here. So that's one piece of it. Another fascinating thing is how you transport food has a huge impact on the climate footprint of a food. So for example, there's foods that are flown around the world off season, like asparagus or blueberries, flown in, and that has a huge carbon footprint compared to even in some cases, even shipping is not the same carbon footprint. There's a British author, I think his name is David Rea, who wrote about that and looked at, you can get blueberries that have been shipped to the UK that have a fraction of the carbon footprint of blueberries that have been flown there. So being aware at your store, well, were these flown here? I'm not going to buy these. These give consumers an opportunity to understand what their behavior leads to and how to change that.
That's a really good thought. Yeah, I never even considered that. Because you assumed everything was come on about, you assume, your bananas come from South America and parts of Africa, and our fruit comes from Southern Europe, where the sunnier places are. But is this all because we've got used to now eating the same food all year round.
Absolutely. We in the West and increasingly in the East, avocados in China coming from Latin America, we like convenience and are being kind of seduced into a certain kind of expectation of eating whatever we want whenever we want it. And that comes at a huge global cost. So, rather than just accepting that, we can say, no, I'm going to wait for tomatoes for when they're really ripe, in the summer when we're growing them locally, or for berries, or for what have you, make your choice there. And if even if we did that half of the time, we would make a difference. Sometimes people say, I'm not going to make that change. It's way too drastic for me. So forget it. But even if you make half that change, that could have a huge impact.
That's good to know, actually, because it has sort of weighed on our mind. Like, for instance, I'll go get some food at a weekend, just to have a little bit of a treat. So we'll get some nice fruit, fresh bread, and things like that. And you're like, well, we all love strawberries, we all love raspberries, we all love blueberries, but to me, they'd be summer fruits. So I shouldn't be able to buy them in winter, should I?
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's an organization called Food Print, like a carbon footprint. This is Food Print. And more
Okay.
you see these things online where you can actually track certain foods, and that's really fascinating. So to try to make consumers aware of the carbon footprint of their foods and what they're eating and the origin of it is a really important piece.
Yeah, because I mean, the other side of all this is you're talking about some of the food groups might disappear into it.
Definitely some, there's a lot of foods that are at risk in different
Yeah.
ways. And at the same time, there's a lot of foods that have been forgotten about that are being brought back.
Okay.
Amaranth, quinoa, chia, those are some that are examples. Different kinds of grains, pseudo cereals that have been very important centuries ago to civilizations, high protein and really good micronutrients, and then they've been out of favor or even banned from being grown because of the rituals attached to them by colonizers. So, the global food system is in huge flux. And if you could have a giant group of people who could plan together and sit at a table and make a plan, like where is this going? What are the foods that are adapting to hotter and drier conditions? What are the foods that can provide great nutrition to needy populations at an inexpensive price? It's one thing to develop these things for boutique, wealthy Westerners, but how is this just and fair for the developing world as well? So it's huge, huge issues. And if only we could get together and work on that together. So check it out, Andy. This is where we're going with photography. We start by talking about
It's different.
photography, but there's all these layers of stories that I'm not even talking about an image anymore. I'm talking about all the texts and the stories and the context behind the images. And that's what's so fascinating to me. You dive into a project and you're looking at something up close in a lens and you go, what is going on here? And
Yeah.
suddenly you have hundreds and hundreds of links of different articles and books and stories to try to unpack that. And it's a fascinating process. And when it comes to food, every single one of us, every single day faces food issues.
Yeah, that's why I think it's a really interesting project in that sense, because you're basically shooting something that appeals to everybody, which is very unusual.
Well, we don't have any choice, do we?
No, exactly, and it's really prominent now that things have to change, and some people are actively trying to change, aren't they? But I think it's on the mind of a lot of people, and but it's down to the youth, I think. If we get them switched on, get them learning, they can help everybody then.
There's an organization called Kiss the Ground, which they've made a film that's very well done on Netflix, and it's beyond
Seen
elsewhere.
that.
Yeah, there you go. So,
Brilliant.
there's a lot of young people involved in that, and older people like myself and beyond. There's a lot more awareness, and it is becoming a sense of, this is really possible. And I started the Food for Thought project, looking at the impacts and the loss of nutrients in foods and the loss of range and, loss of biodiversity, all these things that are really traumatic. And the further I researched, the more I looked at and saw amazing work that's being done for regenerating, we'll just call it regenerative agriculture in particular, where you're looking at rebuilding soils and regaining biodiversity and creating, really much more robust food systems that aren't just a monoculture, but very diverse growing systems that are much healthier and aligned with how the planet works, rather than how industry works per se. So, trying to develop industry in a way that works along with the planet is a kind of a biomimicry idea on a giant scale, and a lot of that work's being done, and a lot of it is very successful. Gabe Brown in America, White Oak Pastures in Georgia. There's, I think, Muldoon Farms in Australia. There's so much going on where people are. And India, retrieving rivers that flow that had dried up over decades by changing, land practices. And it's mind-blowing. The Loess Plateau in China, John Liu of Ecosystem, what is it? Ecosystem Repair. He took 35,000 acres, I believe it was, it might be more. It's worth looking up online. And recovered this whole, basically this desert, and made it with the help of a huge, huge commitment of people into a fertile valley.
I know this. I've seen
Yeah.
this. It's amazing, isn't
Well,
it?
it is absolutely amazing. It's what we need to know about, because this is happening and it can happen, and it just needs the political will and the organization. And to have that as a beacon is so inspiring compared to so much that's traumatic that's happening now. We can easily take that trauma and just say, what's the point? And I'm just going to go enjoy my life because there's not much left of it. And the truth is, it's phenomenally amazing good work going on that deserves to be not only celebrated but developed and linked with other phenomenal work, and then we can do this thing.
To me, it sounds like you're the positive outlooker. Now, would you say then all these stories and things that are happening, science is going to save us?
I think it's the
Or,
human spirit's going to save us. Science has its limits, and it's not just thinking rationally. It's being inspired by being on this planet in the first place, and caring enough to fight for it in a way that is creative and collaborative and deeply observing of what has worked for millions and millions and millions of years. Honoring that. And the human spirit that is can be inspired and connected to that, I think that's what we hope. What that's our source of hope. And science is absolutely a tool, but without that human spirit that talks to each other and gets us excited about what we can do, it's not worth much. It's just like, you know, you can have information and pound people with information, but if you're not touching their hearts, what's the point? You're just going to go, oh, I don't agree with you. Forget it. You're not right. I'm right. And then you didn't get anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So maybe that's where art comes in. Help. That's the human spirit.
Yeah. Cause you have to appeal to, the everyday person more than anyone, don't you? Because there's more of us than there is, you know, people with money or power or whatever.
Yeah, well, and those people need to be touched as well and be inspired. Yeah. And some of them already are, and some of them are doing great leadership. And it's, you know, we are all in this together, as a cliche as it sounds. We need every level. We need all the different thinkers and doers and feelers and creators and of every different class and whatever.
It's wonderful. And you've turned this into like a traveling exhibition, haven't you?
Correct.
That's a fascinating idea. So how does this really work then, Robert?
Well, I started by working with a local museum that wanted to feature this project and worked with a curator who did a great job of, you know, helping develop the concept and the images. And we put something together that Fotokunst is the group I work with as an agent, and they travel a lot of exhibitions around the country and beyond. That basically is available to any venue interested here. So we're reaching out. We've got some things scheduled into 2023 and looking to go beyond that. How it works is, you know, I've got two crates in storage and they're looking for temporary homes to move around to.
Okay.
And, you know, that's something where average is like a 3-month visit to a museum or a university or somewhere. And then we just go from place to place.
No, it's good. Do you follow it sometimes?
Yeah,
as well?
Definitely.
Go with it.
Definitely. I really like talking about the work and interacting with people, as I said. So I definitely accompany it and hike.
I wish I could see it. You have to let me know if it ever comes over.
We'll try to make it happen somehow.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be a few, without a doubt. I mean, it was also interesting that you've used this similar process, talking about the microclimate, wasn't it? Where you've been doing like, is it a microscope picture? Do you know that image that I picked out?
Let me see. Describe it for me so I can find it here.
So it looks like a face in the middle of the screen. It's black and white image. And then you've got like, is it like a feather?
Okay, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It's like a spin.
Yeah. I live along saltwater, and we have barnacles at low tide. So that face is barnacles, several different barnacles. And the feather is actually the cirri, which is like basically the foot that comes out of the barnacle's mouth and catches plankton. So they're filter feeders, and they're sitting on the rock and putting out these cirri and pulling in plankton for their sustenance. So I call this image Barnacles on Acid. It looks like a whacked out, drugged out barnacle, but what's happening really is that ocean acidification is a real thing. And it is damaging invertebrates in the ocean, where especially with, you know, younger plankton, some of their shells are decalcifying, or the calcium in the shells is being eaten up by acid, so they can't fully develop. And this is, you know, this is being seen in a few places. It's not like it's absolutely catastrophic yet, but it's the kind of thing that you'd expect, and it's the kind of thing to watch out for. That's where that image came from.
I see. Again, it's environment. So, this is important stuff. Is that one of your favorite images,
Oh,
or do you
I
have?
think it's a little, I like it. I wasn't really satisfied with the macro capture on that. I like to use a tripod and focus stacking to get really sharp imagery. And this one was handheld, and I did focus stacking, which was, 10 or 12 different images closer and closer and closer, and then stacking them. And when I'm handheld, and the wind is blowing, I wasn't really that thrilled with it. I like the idea. I think it's kind of fun. It's a little bit wacky, but it's just one of the many.
How many images would you take then to stack, for instance?
Depends on what I'm working with, but I probably average around 20 or 25 or something. Not like some people are doing 1,000. There's some things that are just mind-blowing what they're doing, and they're setting things up so meticulously. I'm not quite that radical, but I also end up doing a lot of panorama stacking. So I might go from left to right and then down and right to left, then down and left to right to do the panorama and get a giant image, but then I'm also stacking. So it's getting sharp vertically, but then a lot more detail horizontally, if that makes sense. It's a little hard to speak it, but I've done that with the micrographs too, to make them so that I can enlarge them to a great size and have them be really sharp.
So when you use a micrograph, then is that in a studio type environment, or can you take that out in the
The
field?
scanning electron microscope is definitely in a laboratory.
Oh, you're talking about one of these massive.
No, I'm talking about a small one.
Oh,
Yeah, there's
okay, right.
desktop ones now, and this one that I use was
Wow.
actually designed in Japan for high school students. So the mentor who showed it to me basically gave me an introduction over half an hour and said, "Okay, here's the calendar. Put yourself on the schedule." And over 7 years, I've gotten better and better at it, so that I can get something good out of it. But it doesn't have to be really complicated.
Right, okay. I mean, it must be different though to start shooting on something like that over a traditional camera sort of thing though.
Well, I like to think of it. It definitely is, but I like to think of it as like a hike, and like you're hiking on a micro landscape. So you put on this thing that's like your fingertip, and you're looking at it on a monitor, and you can move the object around. You can swivel it and move it so that you're creating composition, right? So just like if you're going hiking and you're creating composition on the land, here you're creating composition on a little fingertip sized stub, and just creating from there.
I see. So you're looking. Is it because you can't see down the
Right.
microscope, or is it just
No, yeah. No,
right?
it's not even, I mean, it's nothing to look into. It is a beam, an electron beam that's basically reading the resolution of the object. And that's translated through some wizardry that I could never explain onto a monitor. And you can work with focus, and you can work with brightness and contrast and composition and zooming in and out to get, to get it sharp and choose your composition. So that gives you a lot of options. And then yeah, it's definitely not a camera. Not like exactly.
That's interesting though, because I like this idea of looking in something so close it doesn't look like it. I mean, I really liked this black and white image. So it's like half, sort of halfway is like in shade,
Right.
and halfway is in sun.
Right.
So I'm assuming it's sunlight
Right.
slowly either coming or going.
Sunset. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, and a very kind of barren hillside where all the leaves are gone and very dramatic white bark. And just create that kind of sense of, is this, living or dying? Is this a drought or just a seasonal shift? And that whole series, there's just a few images I have in there, but it's meant to just invoke what is so often now, these different cycles of wet and dry, either floods and downpours or droughts, and looking at that in a way that we don't normally see, maybe.
It's a nice way of doing it. And again, it's a very different image to maybe what you'd see in newspapers, for instance, because this is so prominent now. Like this week, for instance, we've had floods.
Right. We just get out of the way or get in the same river going in the same direction. We don't definitely can support it to do what it knows to do best. It's that's what we need to do so much better.
I can't thank you enough for helping educators here, Robert. But what I'd love to do is just put you through my random questions now, if that's okay.
Put me through. Oh no, it sounds threatening, but go ahead.
Doesn't it? No, that's cool. Okay, so I had a good think about something that would suit you. So, okay, I'll take it easy on your first one. So, you're looking down on the Earth from your space flight. What part of the world would you photograph?
Wow, very cool. First thing I think of is a river delta,
Okay.
just with the branches and the filigree and the extraordinary patterns.
Oh, it's amazing, Della, isn't it? From above, I've seen it.
Yeah, and then you can consider that like a micrograph too, because things like that show up in a pinhead scale. So that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
No, definitely. That's nice saying that. Okay. If you could learn an animal language, which animal would you choose to communicate with?
Orcas.
Orcas. Okay.
Where I live, there are orcas. Sometimes we can see from our home, and in fact, we love to snorkel here in the Salish Sea in the Northwest. And last Saturday, we were out snorkeling, and close to the kelp, we were right at the edge, and orcas came around the corner of the point where we were, and we were in the water. And we've seen them a lot from the land, and sometimes from boats, and being in the water with them. They were far enough away that we were okay, but at one point they went down, and I didn't know if they were coming up close to us to threaten us or if they were far away. And they ended up being far away. But it was very exciting. They're extraordinary, and they stay in family pods for decades. And it's just mind-blowing to consider, 24 hours a day, basically, for years and decades, that animals are together communicating and enjoying each other and connecting. And so that's my answer.
No, it's lovely. Yeah, nice. Very nice choice. Okay. If oranges taste of orange, do strawberries taste of straw and butterflies taste of butter?
Oh man, boy, I've never had a chance to find out. Maybe you're setting me up here. I'll let you know. Can I send you an email? Wow, that's a good one. I would think that they do not. No, I think not. But I am
No.
gonna, you got me thinking now.
Yeah, well, we're not all in the who's the famous explorer who ate his way around the world. Oh, this can you remember the name of that society?
I'm not sure.
Oh, it's not a good practice. God, what's his name?
Fascinating though.
And he's a very well-known traveler, and he literally ate everything he could come across on his exploitations, and there's a famous club named after him. It's awful because obviously half these species don't even exist anymore
Right.
because of people like him.
Right.
Right, and it's sometimes you make these amazing discoveries, but at the same time you have these stupid people that think they're gonna last forever. Well, it's like I hear all this stuff all the time, and it's like they were talking about was it the last two white rhinos? And it's family. I think it's mother and son. I think they're the only two ones left in the world. So that's it. The species is gone now. Yeah, and you're just like, my God, that is so sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, you know, we could easily be just defeated by grief.
Yeah.
Which brings up a film you need to see called Albatross by Chris Jordan, who's a fantastic photographer and a friend. And it's all about, okay, about grief and the loss of basically about plastic that is in the guts of these albatross and the parents feeding plastic to the babies and what he does with it. You know, that story is pretty well known now. He's made it, helped make it known. But what he does with creating that film and communicating the grief and how powerful and important that is to feel it, it's really stunning, and it's a must watch.
No, I will do. Yeah, I find that interesting because it's microplastics, isn't it?
Yeah,
and they reckon we're already eating them, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah,
it's a disgusting thing. Yeah. Okay, so your next one. You wake up in the morning and realize no one remembers the Beatles. What do you do? Do you try and educate people, or do you keep the memory?
Oh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. It's like that film a few years back. Boy, I think we'd need Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I think we need him. People would need to know about it. Probably start there.
Yeah. So you. Yeah. Okay. So you'd there. Reintroduce.
Oh yeah.
It. Yeah.
You gotta go okay. through that mind-blowing time.
Amazing music.
Yeah.
I agree. Okay. So, you have to give a punch, a present, and a pint to each one of the following. So you've got Robert Kennedy, Bob Kane, and Bob Marley.
Wow.
You got a punch, a present, or a pint.
Okay. Wow. Who's the second one?
Got Robert Kennedy.
No, and the other one?
Bob Kane.
I don't know if I know who that is.
Oh, Bob Kane's the guy who invented Batman.
There's a punch. Might as well just punch for, you know, Batman's throwing a punch. Might as well throw one back there to the inventor. So that's easy.
Okay, that's easy. Right, that's sorted. Easy,
yeah. A pint.
It's a present or a pint.
Let's see. A pint to Bob Marley there, and a gratitude for amazing music.
Yeah,
and a present to Bob Kennedy, which would be Robert Kennedy, would be probably a bulletproof vest.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I agree with you. Amazing man.
Yeah. Especially how he transformed, because, you know, earlier in his career he wasn't as humanitarian, and around the time of MLK's murder, he just basically, you know, totally transformed. And what he did in addressing a crowd, a mixed ethnic crowd, after that, basically that was one of the only cities that didn't blow up that night. because of his integrity and his depth with it. So anyhow, fascinating stories all around.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. No, well, thank you so much for going through that, Robert. That was good fun.
Great fun. Thank you so much for your interest. It's a pleasure to talk. And I hats off to you, and a pint to you, and a present to you for your efforts in educating and learning and communicating.
No, that's great. My last couple of things. So do you want to tell everybody where we can find you online?
Robert-dash.com is my website, and contacts through there, and parts of the work that I have are up there, and I have lots more that I haven't shown there, but I'm happy to share that with people's requests.
There we go. And obviously there'll be links in the show notes for that.
Awesome.
And then the final one, Robert, is obviously I do this pay it forward scheme, as you know. Is there anyone you think I should check out, or anyone you'd recommend for a future show?
So, you know, I like what Michael did. I'm going to do a combination here. Michael told you about some organizations. There's a mm-hmm. tremendous amount of good work up on the Social Documentary Network.
Okay.
So SDN, you can find SDN. Amazing stories there. There's also a lot of good work up on Lens Culture. There's a tremendous amount of material there. But I want to mention one person's name that I just came across, who is the wife of a friend who also does extraordinary work, and maybe talking to both of them, but Esha, E-S-H-A, and I don't exactly know how to pronounce her last name, C-H-I-O, C-C-H-I-O,
okay.
Chio, perhaps, in New Mexico. She did a wonderful series on regenerative agriculture. She took a really different approach on really similar material that I was working on about food and climate change and regenerative agriculture. But she did it more with a straight documentary, just fascinating look, very, very detailed look at the human side. You know, my images are all more abstract or more realistic, food. And
yeah.
So she's reopening up that story and finding a way to make that material clear to people. So lots of ideas, lots of people to talk to. Her husband, Jamie Stillings, does phenomenal photography from helicopters and planes of solar installations around the world. So they're a really fascinating pair, and so much great work going on. It's hard to go wrong looking into it.
No, that's awesome, Robert. Thank you so much. So all I can say is thank you for taking time out to talk to me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Same with me, and thanks for your time, and all the best to you. Get some rest up your shoulder there, and get those light cameras out there and do your new light camera work.
Yeah, will do. You please take care, and I'll be watching out, and I hope you find a publisher, because that'd be really interesting, Robert, honestly.
Thanks so much. I'll stay in touch.
Will do. Great stuff. Thanks a lot, mate.
All right. Best to you. See ya.
You take care.
Bye.
Hey, I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed interviewing. Please don't forget, if you want to get involved, I'm starting to put out there on social media the list of guests for that week. You are welcome to submit any questions you want to ask, and hopefully I'll read them out for you, whether you want to do that through Instagram. Direct message, you can just click, if you click on the direct message bit, there's a button there and you can record and send that right across. But there's many apps you can do, or email me, or send me a DM on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. That's cool with me. For those of you who want to support the show, please don't forget, iTunes reviews are always appreciated, and obviously I will read them out the following week for you. and I tend to use them on social media, so that's all very much appreciated. If you'd like to help contribute towards the show, then don't forget there's my Ko-fi page where you can submit anything from $1 a pound or upwards, and I'll keep a note on there what I'm trying to achieve as the months and years go by. For those who want to keep coming back to the show, don't forget you can just subscribe in your friendly podcast app of choice, and there's a weekly newsletter on my website, flogger.co.uk, so that's PHLOGGER, and you'll get an automated email from me, and that tells you each week what's gone up on the website. So it's the podcasts and any articles I've wrote. So yeah, thank you so much, and I'll see you again soon. Bye.